So, very pleased to reintroduce Nigel for the fourth of four. Today we'll hear about the assembly math and the BAMCON conjecture.
Yes, indeed. BAMCON conjecture day today. And the test, of course.
Oh, yes.
All right. I may not get as far as I think I advertised that I would get, talking about Hilbert spaces and so on. I will do that, but I don't think I'll do it in a great deal of detail, because it's the last lecture, and we're all like the last few hundred meters of the marathon, you know, you're sort of feeling a little giddy, a little less focused. Okay, B for BAM. Before we get to Mr. Baum, let me motivate what's going to happen by looking at something quite a bit older. This is an interesting construction involving classical things, just elliptic operators, Dirac operators, ordinary compact parameter spaces, and so on. So we'll look at a certain family's index construction. I'll dress it up in the language of K-homology, because that's where we're headed. This is worked out by Lustig in his thesis, I think, in his thesis. Okay, so here's what's going on. Ultimately, we want to make a conjecture, formulate this notorious BAMCON conjecture, which has to do with groups, arbitrary, locally compact groups. Actually, we'll be focusing on discrete groups. But let's just look at the simplest, one of the simplest cases, where lambda is a free abelian group, which we'll think of as a lattice in some vector space V, some real vector space V. Okay, so we can form V divided by lambda, and that's a torus. You can also do the following thing. We can take the dual vector space and divide by the dual lattice, and we'll get another torus. So this dual thing is the set of dual vectors with the property that when you apply them to the lattice, you just get integers. Okay. And if we have a point in this quotient abelian group, you can think of this as a, among other things, as a character one-dimensional homomorphism from this, I should say character of what? Character of lambda. A homomorphism from lambda to U1 in a pretty obvious way will define, if you like, V star of, what should we call elements of this? Lambda. That's e to the 2 pi I times the canonical pairing of V star of lambda. So if V star happens to be integral in the dual lattice, then of course you get 1. So this is well defined as a homomorphism from lambda to U1. Okay, no big deal. And so this is the same thing as, to make this a little more geometric, a flat unitary line bundle, a flat Hermitian line bundle with a flat Hermitian connection. On this space, this one here, because it has fundamental group lambda. Okay. Let's give it a name. L V star. I don't want to call these things V star. I'll just keep calling them that. Okay, so far so good. This is all pretty straightforward. Now we want to do the following thing. I wanted to find a homomorphism, and it goes from K-homology, for example, in the sense, in the geometric sense that we just discussed Tuesday, of this torus. And where you end up is in the K-theory of
the dual torus.
Okay, because, you will see that we end up there when I tell you what the map is. So something in here is given by a cycle. There's a manifold M, which is spin C. It means it supports a Dirac operator. Maybe there's some auxiliary vector bundle over M, which is no big deal, but let's throw it in because that's part of the official definition. And the last thing is a function F, and the function F maps M into this torus. So we can do the following thing. We can take the Dirac operator on M, and we can couple it to E. But we can also take this flat line bundle on V mod lambda, and of course we can pull it back using F to a flat line bundle on M. I'll just call that still LV star. And what I have now is a family of Dirac operators, a family of Fredholm operators, so I can take the index of this family in the way that we were discussing over the course of several lectures. So this thing, as we noted, only depends on the position of V star in this torus, and we can just take the index of this. Okay, it's a construction, and it takes the k-homology of one torus to the k-theory of some dual torus. So far, so good. Using the Dirac operator, this thing here. Remember, it was the Dirac on M. All right, here are some facts about this map, which make it interesting. So, in the Baum-Conn world, this thing's always called mu, so we'll call it mu.
Are you doing something like taking a bunch of eigenspaces?
So what actually am I doing here? Well, this is the ideal of what I'm doing, and then you have to make compromises. The ideal is the following thing. I have here a family of Dirac operators. For each point in this dual torus, I have a Dirac operator, and what I'm interested in doing is throwing away the entire Dirac operator except its zero modes, its kernel. So that'll be a finite dimensional vector space. In fact, it's two finite dimensional vector spaces because they're even and odd. There's some.
So that's sort of a vector. Those two together.
Yeah. So now I've built something which really ought to be a vector bundle as you move the parameter V star around this torus. In fact, there are jumps in all interesting examples. So the this pair of pseudo vector bundles with funny jumps has to be massaged so that it becomes a pair of honest vector bundles, and then you take the difference, and there you are in this K-theory group. Welcome back. Now you're with us. Any other questions? Nope. Okay. Some facts about this map. So the most important fact, which is what we're going to dwell on throughout the lecture, is that mu is an isomorphism. Turns out that mu is an isomorphism. Why is it an isomorphism? Well, I'll tell you. Just be patient. I'll tell you eventually. Here are some other facts. Let's suppose that, let's consider what this map does to certain cycles of certain sorts. Suppose, for example, that M is not just a spin C manifold. Suppose it carries a spin structure. There will be actual functional analysis at some point in the talk, so just be patient. Stay alert. Well, what I was going to say was stay a while, not stay alert. Suppose it's spin. Suppose E is not there. Suppose it's just a trivial bundle. And now suppose one geometric condition. This is some sort of topological hypothesis on a manifold, but let's also suppose that M has positive scalar curvature. So it's a Riemannian manifold, let's say. We fixed a Riemannian metric on it. And suppose it has positive curvature in the weakest possible sense, in this sort of average sense of volume growth near a point. Okay. then we have this funny construction mu, which is given by an index construction, and it applies to one of these things, and what you get is zero. Because now we can go back to figuring out exactly what's going on here. What we've done is we've taken the Dirac operator on a positively scalar-curved spin manifold. We've coupled it to E, which is nothing, a trivial bundle, forget about it, times a bunch of flat line bundles. And now there's a little bit of Riemannian geometry, a little bit of algebra, if you like, you can do, which is this. You can calculate the square of this Dirac operator D, and what you show is that it's bounded below by the scalar curvature divided by 4. So these operators, each of them, each D, M, E, tensor, L, E star, as we're calling them, is actually invertible. So we're in the good situation calculating this family's index, in which both the kernel of this family of Dirac operators is the zero kernel. So it's already a vector bundle. And it breaks up into the odd-dimensional part and the even-dimensional part, and you get 0 minus 0, and 0 minus 0 is 0. So you get 0 over here. Okay. That's one basic observation. Lustig, I don't think, was interested in Dirac operators. He was interested in something else, which I'll tell you about now. So let's look at a different sort of cycle consisting of an M. And I'm going to choose a particular vector bundle, which will be the dual of the spinner bundle. There's some F. This is a Z2 graded bundle, but I want you to forget the grading. So this really only depends on M, because S star is determined by M. So the point of choosing this particular fellow is that you can calculate what this Dirac operator is, and it's just the signature operator. It's another operator, classically, meaning since Attia and Singer, attached to an oriented manifold. This is the so-called signature operator. So it's acting on forms, regular differential forms, no longer funny spinners, but on differential forms. And the kernel of this operator, the null space, the zero modes, which is what we're interested in when we're calculating this index, well, we're imagining twisting by some flat line bundle. This kernel, by a Hodge-type theorem, is just cohomology. It's twisted cohomology. Cohomology with the local coefficients. And the reason that I tell you that is that when you apply the index of families construction to this with a little bit of work, there has to be a little bit of work because you start off with these kernels, but as you vary lambda, these cohomology groups do not—they're not sort of locally constant. They can jump in size, so some sort of regularization has to be done in the usual way with these. And then you're not talking about cohomology anymore, and you've got to wonder what it is you are talking about. But after a little bit of work, what you end up noting is that this thing here—so where does it lie? It lies in here. This thing being this family's index lies in the K-theory of our dual torus. This thing here is a homotopy invariant, an oriented homotopy invariant. Maybe I'll just say over here what I mean. So we have M mapping via F to a torus. Maybe we have another M prime mapping by another F prime to a torus. And maybe we can find an H here which preserves the orientation, which is a homotopy equivalence, and maybe it makes the diagram commute up to homotopy. So in this situation, you can build a two classes, one for M and one for M prime, and you can apply mu to both of them, and you'll end up in here both times. And what you get is the same thing, which is what I'm just explaining what I mean by this statement here. Okay. Now we can put these things together a little bit. Here are a couple of nice consequences. Consequence number one is this, that looking at item number B here, what M should we take in order to say something interesting as a consequence of this expression here? Well, we could take M to be V mod lambda itself, the torus, because then we could take F to be the identity map. Remind ourselves what it is. This is an example of a spin manifold. And it admits no metric of everywhere positive scalar curvature. If we were talking about a two manifold, this would follow from Gasparnet, of course, but for three manifolds and four manifolds, three tori and four tori and five tori, then it's not so easy to see what's going on. This is a famous sort of issue addressed in another way, for example, by minimal surface theory. Okay, what's the point? The point is that if it did have a metric of positive scalar curvature, then mu of this class would be non-zero. On the other hand, you can easily calculate that this class is just a certain K-homology class in the K-homology of a torus. It's a fundamental class. It definitely isn't zero. So you can't have something zero, excuse me, something non-zero going via an isomorphism to something zero and you're done. Okay.
Do I remember right that Hitchin and his thesis did something?
Yeah.
Using the Lichner-Rovitz formula on covering.
What Hitchin did was he constructed spheres, exotic spheres, which are, I don't know, totally non-round. They don't even support a metric of positive scalar curvature. Let alone uniformly positive Riemannian curvature, okay, like the real sphere does. So there are exotic spheres which are so exotic that they're not round at all. Hard to imagine what they might look like. Okay. That uses a slight, it uses mostly a very clever geometric construction, but it also uses a more elaborate index theory over the reals, KO theory instead of KU. Okay, so there's one consequence. Here's something else which looks a little forbidding. Looking at this the example with V mod lambda over on the right-hand side there. If we're in this situation, here are two numbers. Here's a number I'm going to build by integrating over M, and there'll be a number for M prime. What I'll take is the L class, this famous class in topology invented by Hirzebruch, and I'm going to multiply it by the pullback using F. This F here, of any cohomology class on the torus, alpha. Oops, I need to start there. And what you'll get is the same thing over here, except with primes, F prime. So if alpha was 1, this would just say that the L genus of M was equal to the L genus of M prime, and that's true because by Hirzebruch's theorem, the L genus is the same thing as the signature, and the signature being constructed out of just cohomology is obviously a homotopy invariant, an oriented homotopy invariant. But you can build these so-called higher signatures, this thing here. These are examples of what are called higher signatures. You can build these higher signatures, and they too are the same. They're homotopy invariants. This is what's called the Novikov conjecture. I mean, it's no longer a conjecture in this case. For the particular case of the group lambda. So looking at manifolds with maps to, so V-mod, maybe I should say here that the space V-mod lambda, of course, is a famous space from topology. It's the classifying space of lambda. Okay. If it's for me, I'm a little busy right now. Okay. So those are very famous consequences of the sort of machinery that we want to be talking about, this BAMCON machinery. So there's a conjecture here due to Gromov and Lussen and Rosenberg, which I'll state in a simple special case. It says that if M is a spin manifold and is aspherical, if its universal cover is contractible, if the only non-zero homotopy group is the first homotopy group, if M is spin and aspherical, it can support no metric of positive scalar curvature. So it's a sort of geometric guess. Okay. This is the first step in trying to understand non-simply connected manifolds, trying to classify non-simply connected manifolds. It all comes down, in the first instance, to this type of thing here. And I guess you could say this might be the first step in trying to understand positive scalar curved manifolds, but the theory there is so much in a rudimentary state, it's not clear what the second step would be, even if you dealt with the first step here. Okay. So far, so good? Okay.
The flip side of the spherical case, when it's simply connected, I suppose that's in pretty good shape, isn't it?
For this, yeah. That's right. Yeah. Well, it's more this which is in pretty good shape. This is kind of a mysterious thing. I mean, you might want to understand the geometry of the space of all positive scalar curvature metrics on the sphere, for example. Nobody knows a thing about that. Here, of course, we're in Poincaré conjecture land on sphere. There aren't many manifolds which are homotopy equivalent to spheres. Right, what was I going to say? Okay, so now let's venture a little bit to, back towards some functional analytic machinery. What I want to do is sketch to you a picture, which now is going to involve C-star algebras and so on, which attempts to duplicate everything I've been talking about here, not for a free abelian group lambda, but for an arbitrary discrete group. So we'll see how far we can get in drawing conclusions like the ones we've been discussing here for an arbitrary discrete group. Okay, and it's going to be complicated because for an arbitrary discrete group, you don't have this very simple Pontryagin duality picture of this dual torus as being an honest geometric space. And we're going to have to do a little more work. Let me remind you at the very beginning, from the very beginning of these lectures, we've been discussing continuous fields of Hilbert spaces. So now let me, as we venture into the non-commutative realm, let me repackage that idea in the language of what's called theory of Hilbert modules. So suppose we have one of these continuous fields of Hilbert spaces over some X, which could be a compact or a locally compact space. Let's just think compact for simplicity. This is the space of continuous sections, which you're given, remember, as part of the definition part of the package when someone defines for you, someone says to you, this is a continuous field of Hilbert spaces. They're supposed to give you this along with this, otherwise they're misbehaving. So these are the continuous sections. So what can you say about this thing? Well, it's a module. Over functions. If you have a continuous section and you multiply it pointwise by a continuous function, it's again a continuous section. It follows from the axioms. And another sort of interesting thing going on, which is that there's a sort of generalization of the Hilbert space in a product. There's a C of X valued in a product. You have a couple of sections. You can take their pointwise inner product in the fiber Hilbert spaces, and you get a function. And because this inner product is manufactured out of Hilbert space inner products, it has a bunch of obvious properties. It's positive, semi-definite, in fact, positive definite. The only time the inner product of a section with itself is zero is if the section is zero in every fiber, which makes it the zero section. The thing is sort of linear with respect to multiplication by functions. It's conjugate linear. I'm not going to go through all of the simple axioms you have that define what a Hilbert space is. And there's one thing more. So there's a little bit of analysis which you can write down, which is that this space is complete in the following norm. So we'll define the norm of a section to be the following thing. Well, it's just like what you do in the world of Hilbert spaces. You take the inner product of the section with itself. Now you get a function, and now we'll take the norm of the function. Oh, take the square root, I guess. So this thing here is the usual supernorm of a function. It's the standard norm you put on this Banach space C of X, which makes it into a Banach space. Okay. So what I'm defining here, let me just emphasize, but we're about to go into the non-commutative world, so let me just emphasize that right and left make a difference, and we'll think of all of our modules as right modules. You can recover the original field from all of this. So what I've described is the structure of what's called a Hilbert C of X module. Just by specializing. So the fiber at X of this continuous field is what you get by taking a set of all sections, remembering the C of X module structure, and evaluating it's a copy of the complex numbers which carries the C of X module structure which is given by evaluation at little x. And when you do this, because we've ventured into the world of Hilbert spaces and so on, this tensor product should be some sort of completed tensor product in principle, actually, in this particular case, because you're tensoring with something so elementary that I don't think you need to complete. Okay. All right. So here's another way of thinking about continuous fields, and now let's apply that to the situation in which pi is a group, discrete group. There's a version of this Baum-Kahn conjecture for example, Lie groups or Piatta groups, and it's very interesting, and David and I have been fretting about this for quite a while, trying to understand what it really means from the point of view of geometry. However, we'll just talk about discrete groups here. Okay, so a group can be linearized, even a discrete group can be linearized by taking its group algebra, which is an algebra, a complex group algebra, which is a complex algebra, non-commutative complex algebra, and then you can complete that in some way, in some norm, to get a Banach algebra, in fact a C-star algebra, and that's what I want to deal with. Yeah, we have an expert here, so now I've got to fess up to something. So there's more than one. This is an awkward blemish in the Baum-Kahn story. It's a shame that this is so, but there's more than one choice. And there's a canonical one, which is the C-star algebra you obtain by taking the biggest possible norm to complete with. It's the C-star algebra whose representations on Hilbert space correspond bijectively to unitary representations of the group pi. If you're going to build some grand canonical natural conjecture, that's surely the C-star algebra to take. Unfortunately, when you form some grand canonical conjecture using that C-star algebra, it turns out to be obviously false. So you've got to compromise a little bit. So how to say this? When you're in the Baum-Kahn world, really the best choice, to be honest, the best choice is what's called the C-star, the reduced C-star algebra of pi. And what it means is you take this universal C-star algebra, the one I was just speaking of, and you consider what it looks like in the regular representation on L2 of G. So you look at the C-star algebra of operators, if you like, on L2 of G, which is generated by the obvious left translation unitary operators on little L2 of G, given by the group itself. That's a quotient of the universal guy. And why you should particularly deal with that quotient is kind of a tricky question, which, I mean, there's an obvious reason for doing this in the world of Lie groups. There's not an obvious reason at all for doing this in the world of discrete groups. I'm going to write down the Baum-Kahn conjecture at some point. It will have, like we've been discussing, there'll be a map mu with this left science, with a domain, which is some sort of K-homology group, and a range, which will turn out to be some C-star algebra K-theory group, and the left-hand side, and this map is supposed to be an isomorphism all the time, and the left-hand side is obviously functorial in pi. And the universal C-star algebra is obviously functorial in pi, but this reduced fella is not functorial in pi. So what's all that about? You know, you have a conjecture which says that A is equal to B, and B is polite and gets on well with people, but A is, you know, just some sort of reclusive, difficult person, and how could they be one and the same person? Well, you know, we don't talk about that because that's a sort of awkward aspect to the conjecture. That's, I mean, the mere existence of that problem is one of the best reasons for believing it is false. However, we don't know how to manufacture a counterexample. Anyway, having digressed and said that much, I'm not going to keep track of close track of analytic details, functional analytic details from here on. Sorry. When a C-star algebraist writes this without any decoration, they mean this universal C-star max guy. Okay, I forgot what I was going to say. Ah, yeah, so let me get us into the world of Hilbert modules. So this thing, maybe I should just say, if pi is a free abelian group, if pi is a free abelian group, this nuance disappears. All of these C-star algebras are the same. And what you get is the continuous functions on this dual torus, thanks to Mr. Fourier. I was reading a bit about Fourier on a popular user-generated internet encyclopedia, and he had a tough life. He was around the time of the French Revolution, and he had to deal with, you know, bloody tyrants and so on, and it makes dealing with football coaches and outrageous salary increases seem like a piece of cake, you know. If you've got Napoleon on your case, then, you know, you don't really care about the football coach. Okay. Okay. So the wheels have come off this lecture. I need to get focused in again and get going. Okay, so that connects us to the thing that we saw as we were launching into this lecture with this work of Lustig. Okay, now I want to build something which is analogous to that family of flat line bundles which Lustig used to prove the Novikov conjecture for free abelian groups. And it's the following thing. I'm going to write down a name for it just temporarily, just to get us in the right frame of thinking. C star of pi, of course, is an algebra, but it's also a right module over itself. And let me just let M stand for C star of pi with this right module structure. And it's an example of one of these Hilbert modules. Because if I have two elements of M, in other words, two elements of the C star algebra, I can take their inner product using the involution on the group ring, on the group C star algebra, which comes from sending G to G inverse, and then just multiplying against M2 like that. And of course, each element of C star of pi, among which we could choose group elements in pi itself, is by left multiplication an endomorphism. Okay. And now you can do the following thing. Let's form L in the following way. If I have a group pi, the homotopy theorists tell us that we can build a universal example of a space on which the group pi acts freely and properly. That's called E pi. Its quotient by pi is called B pi. It's the classifying space. It's a space whose fundamental group is pi and all of the other homotopy groups are zero. Anyway, I can take E pi and just cross it with M. Now divide out by the diagonal action of pi. So pi, the elements of pi, act as unitary automorphisms of this Hilbert module. They also act as deck transformations on epi, and you can divide out by that diagonal action. And what you get is a flat, unitary bundle with Hilbert module fibers over the space bpi. And it's the universal such. So if you're searching around for flat bundles in order to duplicate what Lustig did, this is the first and last place you need look. Right? If you have any sort of unitary bundle over B pi, then the holonomy of that bundle will give you a Hilbert space or a Hilbert module unitary representation of pi. And once you have such a holonomy representation, you can take L and you can just tensor its fibers to get rid of the C star of pi action with whatever the holonomy representation is. And that will reduce you from a bundle whose fibers are Hilbert C star pi modules to a bundle whose fibers are copies of H. So this is the big guy. This is the universal guy. And now we can just write down something which is rather interesting to consider. Some few words of explanation are required to describe it. We can build such a map by the same formula, basically, as we considered earlier. Let's think of this k-homology geometrically in the way we were discussing. So a cycle for k-homology is a manifold M, basically, together with a map into B pi. And this flat bundle that we built over B pi, we can pull back to M. Now we have a flat bundle on M. We have a Dirac operator on M because M is actually a spin C manifold. And you can let the Dirac operator act not just on spinors, but spinors tensor this thing. Okay. that takes you out of the world of ordinary vector bundles. This Dirac operator is not acting on sections of a vector bundle whose fibers are finite dimensional vector spaces. It's acting on a vector bundle whose fibers are finite dimensional or finitely generated projective modules, actually free modules, over the C-star algebra of pi. But there's really no harm in launching into that degree of generality. It's just like considering families of operators instead of individual operators. This map is you take M, you take its Dirac operator, you lift the Dirac operator or couple it to this Mischenko line bundle, as it's called, and then you take the index. So what is this K-theory thing here? Well, let's take a page out of Kasparov's book and just define this to be homotopy classes. I mean, why not? Of Fredholm operators. On Hilbert, we need to continue the discussion here on Hilbert C star of pi modules in this particular case. When pi is abelian, a Hilbert C star of pi module is the same thing as a continuous field of Hilbert spaces over the dual. So we're talking about families of Fredholm operators on continuous fields of Hilbert spaces, just as we discussed in lecture one or something. Okay? Pi is non-abelian. This is some obvious generalization of that. What I'm doing here is I'm using the Atiyah-Yannick theorem that we talked about in lecture one to define K-theory. Okay? But now we can go backwards, if you like. There is an Atiyah-Yannick result. Which connects this to something a little more reasonable, maybe. For any C-star algebra A, the K0 of A, defined in this way, is the same thing as algebraic K-theory. In other words, it's equivalence classes of finitely generated projective modules over A, made into an abelian group in the usual way. K1 is not completely algebraic. K1 turns out to be pi 0. So K1 is the homotopy classes of self-adjoint Fredholm operators. We discussed that point before. And it turns out to be the same thing as the component group of this topological stable general linear group. Okay, so this is the same thing as the limit of pi 0 GLNA, if you're wondering what the GLN infinity is. And there's a beautiful Bott periodicity picture into which all of this fits, which says two things. First of all, it says that pi j of this space for any C-star algebra is the same thing as pi j plus 2. Yeah, these pi's, by the way, which are now appearing, are regular homotopy groups and have nothing to do with the group pi that was discussed earlier. I mean, I was thinking of this pi as being the fundamental group of some manifold, but here we're talking about homotopy groups. And in keeping with this, pi 2 of GL infinity of A, which is the same thing as pi 4, and so on, pi 1, which is the same thing as pi 3, and so on. This is also isomorphic to K0 of A, the algebraic thing given up here. So, I mean, this, if you've managed to tough out the lectures, this may not seem like such an unnatural thing. This may seem like a reasonable thing to consider. The first time you see these two things together, they may not look so reasonable to consider, but they fit into a beautiful homotopy theoretic picture, thanks to Bott's theorem. And that beautiful homotopy theoretic picture is the same as this analytic picture involving Fredholm operators. That's a version of the Atiyah-Yannick theorem due to Kasparov. Okay, so, yeah, this thing is always called mu. There's something called the Strong-Novikov conjecture, which implies the usual Novikov conjecture that we wrote down earlier for a given group, which says that mu is rationally, after you tensor both sides by q, injective. Part of the inspiration for this is what happened for the group free abelian group lambda that we discussed earlier. Actually, it was an isomorphism there. The other part of the inspiration for this is to think about what happens for a finite group. If you have a finite group, you can calculate what this thing is and there's a copy of Z in it coming from a point, and there's a whole bunch of torsion. There's an infinite amount of torsion crap in this thing. On the other hand, this thing is always a free abelian group. It's a free abelian group on the set of in the case of a finite group, a free abelian group on the space of representations of pi. Free abelian group of higher rank, free abelian group of rank 1 plus crap, torsion crap. So, and you know, this is really the best you can say as things stand. However, so what Baum and Kahn did, and their inspiration came from a completely different direction, which I shan't describe to you, having to do with non-commutative geometry, especially the notorious non-commutative torus. What they considered, and I'll just state it for torsion-free groups, torsion-free discrete groups, they considered this limitation, and for this class of groups, they conjectured that mu is an isomorphism. Moreover, they figured out how to fix the left-hand side of this map here to get a map which conjecturally could reasonably be an isomorphism all the time. Okay. So there are lots of work has been done on these conjectures. A modest amount is known about the Baum-Kahn conjecture. A modest number of cases have been dealt with. There are no counterexamples to this particular form of the conjecture as I've stated it here. You can jazz this thing up in various ways. You can turn groups into groupoids, foliations, or coarse geometric spaces, various things you can do, various conjectures with the same sort of philosophical content as the Baum-Kahn conjecture. And among those various generalizations, there are counterexamples, and they have to do with functional analysis, and they have to do with this awkward issue that one side is functorial and the other isn't functorial. So functional analysis will sooner or later catch up to Baum and Kahn, and I believe, and this conjecture will prove to be false in general. But on the other hand, it's even if it's false as stated, you know, there's some sort of philosophy, some grand Baum-Kahn vision here, which is substantially correct. All right, so I want to, yes?
Is there a simple example
before
we can see what
you mean? The simplest example, is there a simple example of this? Yeah, and that's what I'm going to talk a little bit about. The simple example would be the group of integers or a free abelian group for the conjecture as I've been discussing it here. If you change the conjecture to make the conjecture, make the Baum-Kahn conjecture apply to finite groups, then finite groups would be a great simple example, or compact groups, and there the conjecture would amount to Peter Weyl. Sorry.
If you take the free group on two generators, that's pretty simple, so not so simple.
The free group on two generators is an example of a group where the nuance between the full group Sestier algebra and the reduced group Sestier algebra becomes significant. Of course, it's not an amenable group. It's easy to calculate the right-hand side and the left-hand side for the wrong Sestier algebra, which is the max Sestier algebra. And this map is very easy to check that this is an isomorphism for free group when you use the wrong Sestier algebra. So what about the Baum-Kahn conjecture, which uses the right Sestier algebra? Well, it happens that for a free abelian group, the wrong and the right Sestier algebras, while not being equal, are equal in K-theory. So the natural map from the wrong guy, which considers all representations of the free group, to the right guy, which considers only the regular representation, certainly not an isomorphism. The group is not amenable. But it is an isomorphism at the level of K-theory. We say the group is K-amenable. I mean, we have a better definition than that, which... of K-amenability. So for free groups, everything is okay. And if you're willing to not worry about the nuance between different types of Sestier algebras, then the proof is rather easy. I can discuss that with you later. There's a nice exercise. So free groups are sort of a good example, but there is still a subtlety there. What I'm going to do is discuss what's going on in more detail for free abelian groups, and maybe that will help. Yeah.
The domain of mu is it rationally also isomorphic just a group homology?
Yeah. Yeah. Once you rationalize, K homology and ordinary homology are the same. Of course, you have to periodize ordinary homology, H0 plus H2 plus H4 and so on. Yeah, so this is just group homology, and this is something else. It's really hard. It's a lot harder to figure out some homological version of this in general. These Sestier algebras whether or not you take the whichever one you take, are functional analytically, C-star algebraically, extremely complex for a typical group pi. Very, very difficult to deal with. They don't belong to any of the lower classes of C-star algebras, you know, which Dixmier and Duardy and so on studied very carefully in the 50s and 60s and so on. They're way out there in terms of difficulty when it comes to studying their functional analysis. Okay. All right. Any other questions? Okay. Maybe I'll start over here because I want to go back to free abelian group, so why believe it? I'm thinking mostly of this fellow, although we'll also be talking about that. Okay. Baum and Kahn had their reasons for making this conjecture, as I said, but really they made it with practically no evidence whatsoever, so they were very lucky that they identified the obvious pitfall, which had to do with choosing the max versus the reduced C-star algebra. They're very lucky that they identified that, which to an expert is not a big issue, and that no new thing has arisen yet. But it will, I'm sure. Sorry, Paul. Okay, Alan, sorry. Okay, so let's go back to free abelian case. This is cool. This is one of my favorite points here. So we were looking at a torus, and a dual torus. Here's our map mu. Okay. In fact, let me do it this way. I like this diagram better this way. Here's the official. I mean, it's the same, but here's the official right-hand side. So we'll give Monsieur Fourier his due. Yeah, it's going to get, thank you, now that I've done that. This is the K-theory of the C-star algebra, the very thing that's described here. This is the K-homology of this space. This is the K-theory of this space. And these are the same by Monsieur Fourier. Monsieur Fourier says that the C-star algebra of lambda is the same thing as continuous functions on this space. I didn't mention it, although I guess it follows from my discussion on Hilbert modules, but a K-theory of C, continuous functions on a space, is the same thing as K-theory of the C-star algebra. Sorry, let me say that again. K-theory of the C-star algebra of continuous functions on a space is the same thing as Atiyah-Hirzebruch K-theory of the actual space. So down here is ordinary K-theory. Up here we have funny K-homology, funny K-theory, C-star algebra K-theory. Down here it's just K-theory of a topological space in the sense of Atiyah and Hirzebruch. Okay, thank you, Monsieur Fourier. Now, who shall we put over here? Let's reach into the back corridors of the French Academy and pull out Monsieur Poincaré. This, of course, this manifold is a nice manifold. It's a spin-C manifold. Poincaré duality holds for it, and this K-homology, whatever it is the same thing as K-theory, maybe with a dimension shift, but we shan't get into that. Okay, so there's some other version of mu. Here, maybe I'll call it mu, let's just call it M or something. Now it looks a little promising. And certainly we're now comparing apples to apples. This is K-theory of a torus, and this is K-theory of a torus. It's not the same torus. I mean, it's isomorphic to it, but it's not the same torus, but still it's the K-theory of a torus, okay? And the marvelous fact about this map, which many of you know from seeing it in other contexts, in Mukai duality, is that this map, M, is basically its own inverse, just like the Fourier transform. After all, you want to show this map is an isomorphism. You can calculate this map, by the way, using the index theorem for families, and you can check that it's an isomorphism that way. But if it's an isomorphism, there should be, for a good reason, there should be an inverse map, and indeed there is. It should go from the K-theory of a torus to the K-theory of a torus, and the dual of the dual is the thing you first thought of. So if you apply exactly the same construction to the dual torus, you'll get a map going in the other direction, and it is the inverse up to a sign. Okay. So the Baumkorn conjecture checks, and it checks for a sort of beautiful, simple reason that David would be able to conceptualize. I mean, it just works out beautifully. Okay. And let's see to what extent we can capitalize on that and consider more complicated cases. Let me see if I wanted to say something else before we get on. Yeah, okay, so let's go into this in more detail. When we look at this more carefully, we will find that nothing is wrong. I mean, we're not going to look more carefully and find that we made a mistake. What we'll find is that we have a significant opportunity to generalize this idea of building the same map again to go back. We have a significant opportunity to carry over that idea that the Baumkorn map is its own inverse to a much broader context. Okay. So what's going on here? First of all, this map M is easy to describe. I just put it in as the unique map which made this diagram commute. But you can easily figure out what it is. It's just given by the Dirac operator on V-mod lambda. So here's the recipe. So we start off on the left-hand side, maybe with a vector bundle in the K-theory of V-mod lambda. And we want to get over here to the K-theory of the dual torus. And what you're supposed to do is take the Dirac operator D and lift it so that it acts on sections of E, and then lift it so it acts on sections of these line bundles that we had earlier. And then we have a family. And we just take the index of this family. Okay. That's because Poincaré duality is given by attaching to a vector bundle E down here, the class, if we, let's just call this thing here M for a moment, it's given by attaching to a vector bundle E here, the class M E identity. That's the definition of the Poincaré duality isomorphism. So it's easy to write down what the map is. So let's just think about what the basic construction, the basic analytic object here is, the basic continuous field. Is the following. We'll have a bunch of Hilbert spaces on which these Dirac operator acts. And what are they? They're basically sections of these bundles, V mod lambda, L mod lambda. They're also spinners floating around, but I'll suppress the spinners here. They don't really play a significant role. And now let's think about what this space is. Thank you. Yes, it is. So what is this? So let me say it this way. What is a section of LV star? It's just what you might call a twist periodic function on the vector space V. So it's just a function F, maybe we'll call it FV star, with the property that F of V plus K is V star evaluated on K times F of V. Okay. So by Fourier, So by Fourier, we can think of such an. Let me do it this way. I have a better way of doing it. Let's say the Fourier transform of such a function . This is a bounded function on V, so its Fourier transform is not a function, but it's a distribution. And what is it? Well, it's an element of L2 of the translate of lambda star. Fourier transform of a twist periodic function is a distribution. It's just a sum of Dirac measures on this twisted, on this shifted lattice. Now, how can we get such a family of Dirac measures? Well, we could start off by taking an honest function on all of the vector space V, which vanishes at infinity, say a Schwarz class function on V. We could take its Fourier transform, which is a nice, again, Schwarz class function on the dual space V star, and then we could just restrict it to the shifted lattice, and we'd get a Schwarz class function, a rapid decay function on the shifted lattice. So one way of getting a family of functions like this would be to start off with a single function on V, take its Fourier transform, decompose that Fourier transform by restricting it to all possible translates of the lattice, lambda star, and then for each of those restrictions, take the inverse Fourier transform, and you'll end up with a function which has this property here. In other words, a family of functions, each of them satisfying the appropriate V star version of this relation. It's the same thing as one function on V. And it really is the case that smooth sections of this field of Hilbert spaces, the generating sections of this continuous field, are exactly the same thing as Schwarz class functions, smooth, rapidly decaying functions on V. So this family of sections of flat line bulbs and so on, I mean, what is it? It's just a function on V. It's much simpler than all of that. And that allows us to make the following, draw the following sort of conclusions. So what do we get out of this, this little observation? The basic object we use in which to to construct indices, to construct the map mu, basic field, if you like, thought of as a Hilbert module, is the following very simple thing. It's just a completion in the sense of Banach spaces of the Schwarz class functions on V. Okay, and it has the following structure. We're getting to the point here, the dramatic punchline. It's almost in sight. The finish line of the marathon is almost in sight. Okay, what structure does it have? How do I want to pitch this to you? Yeah. Well, it's supposed to have a structure as a Hilbert, C star of pi or C star of lambda, I guess we're still looking at. At least after we complete. I'll tell you what it is in a moment after I've written down the rest of the structure. It's supposed to have an action. Well, I'll tell you that it does have a representation of continuous functions on V mod lambda as module maps. And then there's some operator D. In order to build the Baumkorn map mu, we have to construct this basic continuous field of Hilbert spaces, which I've reorganized so that we can think of it as just functions on V. And in order to build, we need more than just a big Banach space in order to build the BAMCON map, we need to recognize that this Banach space is one of these Hilbert C star of lambda modules. We need to recognize, to pair with vector bundles and so on, as in Atiyah's definition of K-homology, we need to recognize that this module is actually a module, left module, if you like, over this ring of functions. And also, we need a Dirac operator, and here it is. Okay, so what are these things? So what is this fellow here? Well, if I have an element of the group, I need to tell you how it acts on a function. Actually, it acts on the right. And this action is just going to be translation. So f g of v will just be f of g plus v, probably g minus v. Sorry, v minus g. Remember, we're talking about abelian groups here. What about the inner product? If I have a couple of functions, I'm supposed to be able to take their inner product, and what I'm supposed to get is not a scalar, it's supposed to be an element of the group algebra. Now, an element of the group algebra, otherwise thought of, is just a function on G. So what is this thing evaluated at a point G? Well, it's just going to be F1 times F2 moved by G, and then we'll take the usual and L2 inner product. That generates, from the usual scalar inner product of functions on a vector space, a group algebra of G valued inner product, okay? There should be a representation of this thing, and this is just pointwise multiplication. And there should be an operator, and that's just the Dirac operator. And this collection of data, more or less as in Atiyah's vision for K-homology, provides us with the information we need to build a map from the K-homology, in this case of V mod lambda, to the K-theory of the C-star algebra of lambda.
It's okay. The Dirac operator on the vector space.
Yes.
But because of the group, it's Fredholm.
That's right. It does not give a Fredholm operator in the usual Hilbert space sense, but it does give a Fredholm operator in this sense of Hilbert modules. Okay. And you could easily imagine building this type of structure, seeing this type of structure in more elaborate situations. Suppose, for example, instead of lambda, we had something like a uniform lattice in a Lie group, torsion-free, let's say, since we're talking about torsion-free groups. The role of V would be played by the symmetric space. But having done that, the rest of this would make perfect sense. So here's the data you need, but let me point out the following thing to you. Which is that there's a dual collection of such data. Okay. And this is what we use to go backwards. Instead of taking a C star of lambda module structure, we can construct equally well on this space the continuous functions on V mod lambda Hilbert module structure. And instead of building a left action of functions, we can build a left action of the group. How did I write that? A representation of C of C star of lambda, and an operator. Yeah, maybe I should say over here that this should be an operator in the sense of Hilbert modules, so this thing should be C star of lambda linear. So how would we do this? Well, we have functions on V. I want to build an inner product on functions on V, and I want to build it in such a way that the inner product of two functions on V is itself a function on V mod lambda. How shall I do it? Well, I'll take two functions on V, and I will pointwise multiply them. I'll actually multiply one by the complex conjugate of the other, like you do in Hilbert space. Now I have a function on V, and I will just add it up over the cosets of lambda, and then I'll have a function on V mod lambda. As long as I'm dealing with, say, Schwarz class functions, that makes perfect sense. And it defines an inner product and a Hilbert, after you complete, a Hilbert module structure for this C-star algebra. So we're turning things around, and instead of looking at convolution algebras coming from groups as being the basic object, we're looking at regular functions as being the basic object. Functions on V are a module over functions on V mod lambda, but in fact they're a Hilbert module over functions on V mod lambda. There certainly is a representation of C star of pi. What is that? Well, it's just the usual translation action. That translation action commutes with the multiplication action by periodic functions. So this is an action by C of V mod lambda module endomorphisms. Now, what about this operator? It cannot be the Dirac operator. That's no good, because we want whatever operator it is, it has to be linear with respect to multiplication by functions. And differentiation isn't, okay? On the other hand, it doesn't have to be equivariant with respect to the representation of the group. In fact, we don't expect that. We expect there to be some interaction. What should we choose for this thing? We'll just take, well, of course, now I have to, let me just say multiplication by x. In one dimension, I would just be talking about multiplication by x. In higher dimensions, when you build a Dirac operator, you really have to remember that there was some spinor vector space here, which I suppressed. And here, the right thing to do is to choose flipped multiplication by V and V. Any operator which commutes with multiplication by functions has to be multiplication by some other function, and we'll just choose multiplication by a matrix-valued function, namely this Clifford matrix-valued function. So we've built a dual set of data in which the roles of the space V mod lambda and the C-star algebra of lambda have been reversed. And it builds a map exactly backwards in the opposite direction to the Baum-Conn conjecture. Okay? And when can you build this map? Certainly you can build this whenever you have a vector space, well, a Euclidean vector space, since we used the inner product to build the Dirac operator. But you could easily build it in other cases. Suppose, for example, we had a uniform lattice again. Then V, the role of V would be played by the symmetric space. And the symmetric space is, via the exponential map, isomorphic to a linear vector space. And so we could take Clifford multiplication, according to this formula, on the tangent vector space at a point in the symmetric space, and we could exponentiate it to a Clifford multiplication operator on the symmetric space. And we would obtain an operator with all of the right structure, and we would build a map which tries to invert the Baum-Conn map. And this is what Kasparov did, and he proved in this way the Baum-Conn conjecture, 50% of it, the injectivity part of the Baum-Conn conjecture, the part which is relevant to the Novikov conjecture for any discrete subgroup of a Lie group. And what Kasparov and I did, and I don't have time anymore to talk about it, is we contemplated the following case. I mean, suppose you have a group which acts isometrically, affine isometrically, not necessarily on a finite dimensional vector space, but on an infinite dimensional, say, Hilbert space. So morally, there shouldn't be any trouble. as long as you can figure out what the Dirac operator is over here and this dual Dirac operator is over here, now you have a Clifford algebra with an infinite number of variables, so more analysis intrudes. Morally speaking, it doesn't seem too hard to imagine that you could construct a dual Dirac operator, as it's called, in the case of a group acting on a Hilbert space, as long as you can cope with that infinite dimensional Hilbert space as a geometric space, not as a space of functions, but as a space itself. So we're now at order 2 or 3 in Borchardt's stratification of the mathematical universe. And that works too, but that situation is much better than the Lie group situation because the geometry of affine spaces is much better than the geometry of symmetric spaces in the sense that every isometric action on an affine space is homotopic through actions to an action with a fixed point. You can shrink off the translational part. That key extra ingredient allowed us to analyze not just the injectivity of the Baum-Conn conjecture, but the surjectivity as well by reducing it to an infinite dimensional general case of Bott periodicity. All right, it's time to stop. Thank you very much.